Good morning, everyone. We're in Book 6, the Book of Fate, Canto 2, The Way of Fate and the Problem of Pain. And I think we stopped on page 458, perhaps line 768. Well, we might have read it. Splendid failures. Some to victory. Okay.
I have also intruded.
All right.
277.
277. Yes, further down. So we'll go on from there. At the bottom of page 458. O soul. Intruder in nature's ignorance. You'll begin, Patty.
O soul, intruder in nature's ignorance, armed traveler to the unseen supernal heights, thy spirit's fate is a battle and ceaseless march against invisible opponent powers. A passage from matter into timeless self. Adventurer through blind, unforeseen time. A forced advance through a long line of lives. It pushes its spearhead through the seasons. Across the dust and mire of the earthly plain. On many guarded lines and dangerous fronts. In dire assaults and wounded slow retreats, holding the ideals ringed and battered forth, or fighting against odds in lonely posts, or camped in night around the bivouac fires, awaiting the tardy trumpets of the dawn, in hunger and in plenty and in pain, through peril and through triumph and through folly, through life's green lanes and over her desert sands, up the bald moor along the sunlit ridge, in serried columns with a straggling rear, led by its nomad vanguard signal fires, marches the army of the way-lost God.
Thank you. Narad is replying to Asvapati's question. Is the spirit ruled by an outward world? And then he asks him about fate. What is fate if it's not the will of the spirit getting fulfilled after a long time by the cosmic force? And a third question he asks about Savitri herself. He says that I thought that a mighty power had come with her, that she is incarnating a mighty power. Is not that power the high compeer of fate? Isn't it as powerful, maybe even more powerful than fate? But Narad answers in a roundabout way. He doesn't want to give a straight answer at this point. He does say that, he's speaking now about fate. Last week we read about fate. And he's telling us that behind what seems like fate or blind chance, there's always a meaning. And the first part was about man in general. And then he tells that man can accept his fate or he can refuse it. And if you refuse, even if the one does not change the decree about your fate, he writes your refusal in your credit page. No, it accumulates something for the future. No. for doom is not a close, a mystic seal. Arisen from the body's torture and death, the spirit rises, mightier by defeat. Its godlike wings grow wider with each fall. Its splendid failures sum to victory. And then he says that the events that meet us on the road, even though they are very painful or very intense with joy, these things are not the fate. These things touch a while and they pass. The goal, thy goal, the road that you choose, that's your fate. And your fate, our fate of each of us, is a long sacrifice, a long process of offering to the gods until they have opened to thee thy secret self and made thee one with the indwelling God. So we have to make these sacrifices, these offerings to the cosmic powers. But eventually they will open up to us the indwelling God that each of us is carrying within ourselves. And then he addresses the soul. That is what Patty just read now, and says that, soul, you are an intruder. You've come here from another world into this world of ignorance of nature, but you're an armed traveler. You come from the supernal heights, and the soul's fate, thy spirit's fate, is a battle and a ceaseless march against invisible opponent powers. There are all these opposing powers. But what has to be done is a passage from matter into timeless self. The soul has to discover its timeless, eternal self. And then there's this long description about the army of the way-lost God. And I remember one of our elderly friends, I think now he must have passed away, but in his youth he had been in the army, and he pointed out this passage to me from his training times. He says, Schirbindo has described it exactly. It's like that. You know? How you have to go on and on and on. Very, very beautiful image. This is the army of the way-lost God, the divine being who here, involved in the world of matter, doesn't quite know where to go. The way is not clear. So there's this long, painful march. This is the march of the soul in evolution, I suppose.
Way-lost means actually
he's lost his way.
So
wandering. Wandering. But there are some leading, there's some signals up ahead. The vanguard, nomad vanguard, that's always on the move. That's the very front, the ones up at the front. They light their signal fires to show the way. And then there's the main mass of the army and its serried columns. They're quite orderly, no? And at the back, there's the stragglers, the ones who can't keep up.
I have this way-lost God as us.
Yes.
Well, our divine part, yes. Yeah. That's us.
Is
But there's an army of us.
Is that the reason, or maybe this is the reason why we got here, we have not the capital G as it happens in other gods?
Yes, it's the small god, divine and in involution, yeah. Pushing its spearhead through the centuries. So this march goes on over a very, very long time. When you're in the army, they play a trumpet in the morning to wake you up, the reveille, yes? But here in this image, that wake-up call is the new dawn coming again and again. But if you are there encamped in the night and you're hungry and you're cold, you wait a long time to hear those tardy trumpets, they seem, you think, will they never call? And the ideal is like a fortress. It's something that has to be protected. It's getting a siege, besieged and attacked and damaged all the time. But the army has to protect that fortress, that strong hold of the ideal. At the end, it's as if they come to some high place, up the bald moor, which is very bare and barren. But then at the top, you get to the sunlit ridge. There's more light. You can see a wider vista.
Yeah, I must say, I feel a little bit disturbed that this path and direction is completely randomized. Is it really like this?
That it's random?
Yeah. It's just an erratic kind of direction this Velos God takes. Is it really like that?
No, I don't think it's like that. What gives you that idea? It's not just wandering. No, it knows where it's going and what the task is. But it's not always clear how to get from A to B.
But isn't we all have our own path?
Yes.
So we will all go through these things on our own path.
Yes.
For me, it's also this first line, also into their nature's ignorance, because in life divine we are just in this path, no? That you have to, how you say, have nature also become more conscious, no? So it is also expressed. No?
Yes. No, so many of the problems, our problems, the problems of the soul, it's because something in us doesn't belong to this nature, this ignorance of nature, this resistance of nature. And so there's a tension and a conflict. That's why there's this battle and ceaseless march, because in nature, in evolving nature, nature evolving from the inconscious, there are all kinds of opponent powers that we have to deal with.
So this is a passage from matter into time itself.
Yes, this is the evolutionary journey. And he describes it in terms of a long march of an advance, and that was what struck my friend, that the description was so poignant and so accurate. He felt very much touched by it. As if Sri Aurobindo knew exactly what it's like to tramp along with all your your caparison, your paraphernalia, and through the vicissitudes in hunger and in plenty and in pain. You'll read on, Don?
Then, late joy ineffable is felt. Then, he remembers his forgotten self. He has refound the skies from which he fell. At length, his front's indomitable line forces the last passes of the ignorance, advancing beyond nature's last known bounds, reconnoitering the formidable unknown. Beyond the landmarks of things visible, it mounts through a miraculous upper air till climbing the mute summit of the world, he stands upon the splendor peaks of God.
Thank you. So when the way lost God finds himself, then he finds the way also, and he can lead the army to the splendor peaks of God, forcing the way through the last passes. An army on the move has to be very careful when they come to passes, because that's where the enemy can easily stop you, you know, forces its way through.
It's incredible how it passes from the army, and he remembers it.
This is the God, the way lost God, the leader of the army, yes.
The whole masses of an army that
would we'll follow him.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
Why does he use the word army? Why is this army marching?
Because this is a battle.
Against what?
Against the invisible opponent powers. This is the battle of the future. You know, in the ashram school, the mother made all the students repeat every day this wonderful prayer that may we be your hero warriors to fight the battle of the future against the past that wants to endure.
So that the new things manifest, and then you may be ready to receive them.
Yeah.
It seems like a contradiction in a way, because to battle is very different than surrendering.
Maybe really to surrender demands a battle with oneself, with the opponent powers in yourself. These are not opposites, these are complementary. So.
For life divine.
So, but then he answers this last question about Savitri's own fate. Sergei, would you read?
In vain, thou mourns that Satyavan must die. His death is the beginning of greater life. Death is the spirit's opportunity. The vast intention has brought to souls loss, and love and death conspire towards one great end. For out of danger and pain, heaven bliss shall come. Time's unforeseen event, God's secret plan. This world was not filled with random bits of chance. The blind God is no destiny's plan. The conscious power has drawn the plan of life. There is a meaning in each curve and light. It is an architecture high and grand, by no name and nameless mazes lit, in which unseen hands are made the unseen, and of its master builders.
Thank you. This meeting of Satyavan and Savitri is not random. A vast intention has brought these two souls close. And the forces of love and the force of death, which seem to be opposites, they are in fact both working together towards one great end. One great result, because out of this pain and suffering, heaven bliss shall come. Something completely unforeseen, time's unforeseen event, God's secret plan. this is Narad's promise. Mm. It's all going to lead to something wonderful and unexpected. And then he answers Helmut and he says, this world was not built with random bricks of chance. It's not that we're wandering about. A blind God is not the architect of destiny. There's a conscious power which has drawn this whole complex plan of life in which there is a meaning in each curve and line. And this high and grand architecture is being built by many named and nameless masons. The masons are the ones who have to build the great cathedral. Oh. And the hands that are putting the stones may not know what they are doing. Very often they don't know, but they are obeying that plan. And she, Savitri, is one of the master builders. She's one of the most important of these workmen on this great architecture of the world. And now we come to the last passage that Sri Aurobindo dictated before he said, all right. Now these lines, we're going to start reading now from line 826 to the break on page 462. According to Nirodh Baran, this is the last lines that Sri Aurobindo dictated in mid-November 1950. And when he'd finished them, and he must have had a look at these last few lines which had already been written and thought they were okay, he didn't change anything. Then he asked Nirodh, he said, is that all? They were going step by step revising the earlier versions of Savitri. And he'd newly composed whole parts, book 7, book 10, book 11. So he asked Nirodh, is that all? And Nirodh said, there's still the book of death and the epilogue. And Sri Aurobindo said, that will be for later on. Later on. Whatever he may have meant. So Nirodh says, with those words, he put his seal of incomplete completion on the poem that we have. So let's have a look at these powerful lines. Maria.
Queen, strive no more to change it will. Time's accidents are steps in a vast king. Will not thy weak and helpless human ears accord to tears. Will not that weak and helpless human tears accord to catalyst moments of a heart that knows its single will and God's as one. It can embrace its hostile destiny. It sits apart with grief and facing death. Affronting adverse fate, armed and alone. In this enormous world, standing apart in the mightiness of a silent spirit will, in the passion of a soul of sacrifice, the lonely strength facing the universe, affronting fate, asks not man's help, nor God's.
Sometimes when life is charged with earth destiny, it cries not for succor from the time-bound powers. Alone, she is equal to a mighty task.
Thank you. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything?
I have a note here. The mother, when Sri Aurobindo died.
Yes, I think if, as we go on with this passage, we will see that when Sri Aurobindo was writing this, he knew very well that she would be left alone to carry on this task. But it's also entirely appropriate to the poem.
Yeah.
And the two things
are... It's kind of nice to think that.
Is the heart, yes. These are fathomless moments of Savitri's heart. She said, "My will is God's will." No? She had said it. Those were those words that nobody could answer at the end of book of Canto One. Yes, that's what she says. My will is part of the eternal will. My strength is not the titan's, it is God's. Yes, yes, he can see her strength. But it may be that he cannot foresee what is going to happen, this time's unforeseen event. But he can see that this coming together of Savitri and Satyavan has some great significance and that something is going to come out of it. No, he says, out of danger and pain, heaven bliss shall come. And that's the mighty intention behind all this. So all our human emotions, her mother's emotions, are very, very natural, but they have no place here. No, don't bring them in here, he says.
So he says this actually in the presence of Savitri.
Yes.
So is there any confirmation from herself?
No, I mean, it's not shown, but this is what she already feels herself. She's already stated it. She says, if Satyavan's going to die, then that year is all my life. But she said, I know that's not all my life. There's something more to come. And of course, that's even before she starts doing any yoga. Soon now we shall... go into the book of yoga, and there at the beginning we see the human Savitri suffering all that sense of foreboding and loss and the difficulty of keeping this secret and so on. So he's speaking directly to Savitri's mother. Rashid, you would read?
Intervene not in a strife too great for thee, is struggled in thee for mortal thought to sound its question for his nature's rigid bonds. When the soul finds new gods, the infinite, its too vast thing of a lonely mortal will, facing the silence of eternity. As a star companion moves in heaven, unastonished by the immensities of space, traveling infinity by its own light, the great are the strongest when they stand alone. A God-given mind of being is their force. A ray from self-solitude of light, the guide. The soul that can live along with itself needs God. Its lonely universe is the rendezvous. A day may come when she must come, stand unhelped on a dangerous brink of the world's doom and harsh, carrying the world's future on her lonely breast, carrying the human heart in a heart-left soul. To conquer or fail on a last desperate verge, along with death and close to the extinction's age. A single greatness in that last dire scene must cross along a perilous bridge in time and reach an apex of our destiny where all is on or all is lost for man.
Thank you. So here we we have an echo of what we've read in Book 1, Canto 2, the issue. There we're told that Savitri has come to wrestle with the shadow she had come and must confront the riddle of man's birth and life's brief struggle in dumb matter's night. Whether to bear with ignorance and death or hew the ways of immortality, to win or lose the godlike game for man, was her soul's issue, thrown with destiny's dice. So that is what she has come for. And then we're told, but not to submit and suffer was she born. To lead, to deliver, was her glorious part. A conscious frame was here, a self-born force. So at the end of that canto, Shobindo assures us of the victory to come. So that is what Narad is prophesying. On the other hand, it's very poignant to think of Sri Aurobindo looking forward and seeing what it will be like for the mother to have to stand alone. Mm-hmm. Audrey, you would read?
Cry not, Nicholas.
No, no. In that tremendous
lone and lost. Of a deciding hour in the world's fate, in her soul's climbing beyond mortal time, when she stands, soul with death, or soul with God. Heart upon silent depths of dream, alone with yourself and death and destiny, as on some verge between time and timelessness, when being must end, for life rebuild its base. Alone she must conquer, or alone must fall. No human aid can reach her in battle. No armored god stands shining at her side. Cry not to heaven, for she alone can save. For this, the silent force in mission gets down, and her the conscious will took human shape. She only can save herself and save the world.
Thank you.
For this, the silent force came as a support, right?
No, she is an embodiment. Savitri is an embodiment of the supreme force, of the supreme mother, of the will of the conscious will. She has taken human shape for this work.
She only can save herself and save the world.
Mm.
And it seems to me historically none of the avatars and people who came said that exactly. They all had a mission, but it was not, they didn't say they were coming to save the world.
The idea with the is that Jesus, by his death, has saved the world. He's the Redeemer.
Yeah, but I thought that was
you mean the
Redeemer of our spirit, not the Redeemer
of the material
world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Jean-Yves, you would read on.
Oh, Queen. Stand back from that stupendous scene. Come not between her and her hour of fate. That hour must come, and none can intervene. Think not to turn her from her heaven-sent task. Strive not to save her from her own high will. Thou hast no place in that tremendous strife. Thy love and longing are not arbiters there. Leave the world's fate and her to God so dark. Even if he seems to leave her her own strength, even though all falters and falls and see the man, and the heart fades, and only are death and night, God given her her strength can battle against him, even on a brink where death alone seems cold. And no human strength can hinder of him ever. Think not to intercede with the hidden will. Intrude not with her spirit and its faults, but leave her to her mighty self and faith.
Thank you. And if we connect all this with the passing of Sri Aurobindo and the mother being left to carry on his work in the world, the next lines also seem extraordinarily appropriate, the closing lines of the canto. Would you read them, please, Mihong?
Vanishing into the light of the unseen, but still a cry was heard in the infinite. And still to the listening soul on mortal earth, a high and a far imperishable voice chanted the ending of eternal love.
Thank you. Of course, I don't think that Sri Aurobindo turned away from the strife and suffering on our globe. If he left the body, it was to go on working from the subtle planes on all this strife and suffering. But anyway, he disappeared from our physical eyes, and he's left this anthem of eternal love, which we can hear with our souls. His high and far imperishable voice.
Back here on 460, the bottom, it says, unastonished.
Isn't this a lovely line?
Isn't that great? Unastonished, the star, unastonished.
Star uncompanioned and unastonished by the immensities of space. Yeah.
Traveling infinity by
its own light.
And you can just put that on him.
Mm. Yes. The great are strongest when they stand alone.
It's just a wonderful vision or symbol or whatever.
Yes.
When vision must end for life revealing space, life revealing space, I'm thinking of the beginning. I know, it's kind of an
explanation. Which line is it? I'm sorry.
It was 94. Which page?
Page 461. Yes, where being must end. Yes, this thing that Savitri has to do, it's, Sri Aurobindo depicts it as happening on a brink, on the edge of something. Things might go this way or that way. It's not sure. So this is a brink. A silent, desperate brink where being must end, where existence itself must end, or there must be a whole new base, a whole new foundation given for life. Well, you can think about DNA if you like, but I think it's something much more momentous than that. This is the conflict with the principle of death, of negativity. That is what Savitri has come to do. I'm just looking for that place, this colloquy of the eternal gods. Here. Page 12. On this page, Sri Aurobindo is explaining what Savitri is facing when she wakes up on that morning when Satyavan must die. She's reached a point where for her life must be in vain, or in her unborn element awake, her will must cancel her body's destiny. The will, the unborn element of her, the eternal, immortal element of her, must assert its will over the destiny of the body. And he says only the unborn spirit's timeless power can do that. And then lower down, he says, that her confrontation that she will have to have with death is a colloquy of the original gods meeting upon the borders of the unknown. Her soul's debate with embodied nothingness must be wrestled out on a dangerous, dim background. Her being must confront its formless cause against the universe, weigh its single self. And it goes on like that. It says, if in this sentence the original gods, this seems to be Savitri herself, representing the eternal yes, and the figure of death representing the eternal no. And which of them is going to win? But for her as an individual embodied being on earth, what she has to confront is her formless cause. Has she come out of something without form? And is form allowed to have a lasting existence or not? She must vindicate her right to be, to go on existing, and to love. And in order for that to happen, a big change has to come about. Altered must be nature's harsh economy, the way things are balanced out in nature. This has to change.
Is this like an evolutionary leap?
It's maybe something even more than that.
So, the new world, what, in 1956, and came down with energy.
She has to overcome the power of death. Yes, it seems to be like that. There's a letter in which Sri Aurobindo says that this whole story is supposed to have happened long, long ago at the beginning of human time, when it was necessary to open up some new possibility for, you perhaps can say, an evolutionary possibility. And then we see how Savitri in part three of the poem has to face every kind of opposition represented by this figure of death, every denial of this possibility which she's come to bring, the ways, opening the ways of immortality. And when finally she receives the sanction of the Supreme, and he says, what you have asked, I grant, it shall be written out in destiny's book, it will be fulfilled by my trustee, eternal time. And then there's a prophecy, a long prophecy in two parts. The first part tells what this will mean for Savitri herself. What this victory that she's won, what it will mean for herself, and then what it will mean for the earth. He says, return to earth with him thou lovest. And he says that Satyavan is the soul of the earth. So that's what she's won. That this soul doesn't have to be always in the subtle realms in the heavens. It can be realized and lived here in the material world. But he sets it, in that prophecy, he sets it far in the future. That's not the only theme which is touched on in this book, but it's a very central one.
Not to intercede with the hidden will, no? Include not fixed the spirit and the cause. Sometimes I feel that things, thinking come about how it should be, and I feel the energy when also is not appropriate to the higher will, so we can experience this also in our process. No? Let's say, try to be open to the divine will. I mean, the mother, of course, did such another work.
also for us it's, it could be a hint, or for me it is a hint, that when I feel, it's not in the flow or in this one, then I try to be open, what is the divine will?
Yeah, I suppose that's what surrender is about. Yes. Yes.
Please speak louder.
Don didn't hear you. Would you like
to
repeat yourself?
The consciousness of possibility is a much higher consciousness than the consciousness of limitation. It reminds me of, Einstein's famous quote, "The world's most pressing problems cannot be solved at the same level of thinking and creating."
Yes.
Thinking of limitations.
Yes. It means moving to another dimension. And that's, yeah, if we come up against an insoluble problem. Then we have to look for the solution on another level. In our personal life or the world's life. We have a little time. Jean-Yves, would you read those last lines again? From page 460, line 8 to 6, to the end of the section.
The end of the chapter?
To the end of the section. No, sorry. Go back to page 460. And these last lines that Sri Aurobindo wrote, "Queen, strive no more." It's quite a long passage. But I think it's good for us to hear it as all one.
Queen, strive no more to change the secret wind. Time's accidents are steps in its vast scheme. Win not thy grief and helpless human tears across the fathomless moment of a heart that knows its single will and us as one. It can embrace its hostile destiny. It sits apart with grief and facing death, affronting adverse fate armed and alone. In this enormous world standing apart, in the mightiness of her silent spirit's will, in the passion of a soul of sacrifice, her lonely strength facing the universe, affronting fate, asks not man's heart, health, nor doubts. Sometimes one life is charged with earth's destiny. It cries not for succor from the time-bound powers. Alone she is equal to her mighty task. Intervene not in a strife too great for thee, a struggle too deep for mortal thought to sound. It's question to this nature's rigid bounds. When the soul fronts knew that God was the infinite, it's too vast theme of a lonely mortal will, facing the silence of eternity. As a star and companion moves in heaven, an astonished by the immensities of space, traveling infinity by its own light, the great are strongest when they stand alone. A God-given mind of being is their force. Away from self-solitude of light, the die. The soul that can live alone with itself meets God. Its lonely universe is their glory. A day may come when she must have an help. On the dangerous brink of the world's doom and hers, carrying the world's future on her lonely breast, carrying the human hope in a heartless soul to conquer or fail on a last desperate revenge. Alone with death and close to extinction's edge, a single greatness in that last dire scene must cross alone a perilous bridge in time and reach an apex of world destiny where all is gone or all is lost for men. In that tremendous silence, lone and lost, of a deciding hour in the world's fate, in her soul striving beyond mortal time, when she stands soul with death or soul with God, apart upon a silent death's great ring, alone with herself and death and destiny, as on some verge between time and timelessness, when being must end or life rebuilds days, alone she must conquer or alone must fall. No human aid can reach her in that hour. No armored god stands shining at her side. Cry not to heaven, for she alone can save. All this, the silent force came missioned down. In her, the countess will took human shape. She only can save herself and save the world. O Queen, stand back from that stupendous scene. Come not between her and her hour of fate. Her hour must come and none can intervene. Think not to turn her from her heaven-sent paths. Strive not to save her from her own high will. Thou hast no place in that tremendous strife. Thy love and longing are not arbiters there. Leave the world's fate and her to God's soul God. Even if it seems to leave her to her lone strength, even though all falters and falls and sees men, and the heart fades, and only of death and night. God given her strength can battle against doom, even on a brink where death alone seems close, and no human strength can hinder or can help. Think not to intercede with the hidden man. Intrude not to express spirit and its thoughts, but leave her that her mind discern and fail.
I think that mother reads the last bit. Yes.
The last one.
Just the last one.
You spoke and ceased?
No. Yes, just the last one. A ray from self-solitude of light, yes. Yes, I know where the line is. It is connected, I think, with the force in the previous line. The great are strongest when they stand alone because they carry within them this God-given might of existence. That is their force, their unique force. And that is like a ray from self-solitude of light, the supreme state of the self, the supreme sun, a ray of that light comes to the great individual who has to stand alone. That is my understanding. From the supreme, yes. That's the guide.
Yes.
Like the star travels by its own light. Yes. We can think of the image of the supreme sun, the sun of truth, the sun which has given rise to everything, but which is beyond all this. And each soul, and particularly when it reaches its full development, it is a ray, a single ray, a unique ray of that sun. It's just a personal understanding. But just the last bit about Narad leaving.
Have you only spoke and ceased?
Yes.
Only this one.
Yes, difficult to see sometimes. Shri Aurobindo.